I was about to end Unsolved Mysteries Rewind when my previous co-host decided that she no longer wanted to work on the show. It was a sad and uncertain time for a show that had a growing listener base and got about 20,000 downloads per episode. I am so lucky to have worked with remarkable talents such as Amy, Lindsay, Kim, and Catherine, all of whom I can't thank enough for their work ethic and dedication, but due to scheduling conflicts and life, they weren't able to record very often. I put out the feelers for talent on the Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Facebook group, and I got a few messages here and there. I got one simple message from an Aussie named Laura, and she was interested. We had a whole back and forth because she's about 13 hours ahead of me. It took weeks to settle on a time, but once we finally sat down, same time to talk, we had an immediate rapport. Laura's passion for research seemed never-ending, and even now I can't believe the amount of work that she put into each and every episode that we worked on together. I looked forward to recording each session with Laura, and we would swap who would be a half hour late or a half hour early because Australian time zones are crazy. But Laura was always ready to go. She was always chipper, sweet, and ready to discuss the darkest of subjects. But when Laura finally confided in me that she wasn't doing well, like really not doing well, all of these true crime stories were put on hold. Laura was pretty blunt, and there was no candy coating it. She flat out said that her days are numbered and that she just wants to record some shows. So we did. This episode was recorded on December 11th, 2022, and Laura would pass away 2 weeks later on December 26th. She was full of energy, and I considered her a good friend. I want to thank her father, Graham, for his support for the show and for allowing me to release this episode as a tribute to Laura. As of right now, this is the final episode of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. If you're interested in following the other work I do, you can check out The Crimes of Long Island, which can be found at crimesoflongisland.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Welcome to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. I am the co-host Laura, and joining me today, as always, is the host Mark. How are you going, Mark?
Well, I'm just the co-host. We're just co-hosts. So I'm your co-host, you're my co-host.
Okay, deal. Anyway, joining us as always is my co-host Mark. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Laura?
Yeah, pretty good. Thank you for asking.
So it's been a crazy, couple of weeks. I just threw myself off there. Cause I don't know. People tend to think like I need to be the host, but yeah, I don't like that. I think I like there to be that partnership, you know, that's all.
No, that's very true. But you should have seen when you had that time off and you're on hiatus, people missed you. Oh. People did. Yep.
Those so three people.
Okay. It was only one. No, I'm just kidding.
That's no. Okay.
Be flattered. We do a good job. We have good banter, and that's what's important in a partnership, I think. So
yeah, we have a good time. Tonight we're tackling two cases, right?
Yes, two in one. That's right.
I don't know. Have we ever tackled more than one case per?
Yes, we have. We did before. I think it was the Tom Cooter and the Wadada case.
Oh, just yeah, Wadada. Oh, that was, that's yes. That's a terrible one.
I think it was just because they were both sort of two shorter cases. They mm-hmm. weren't really long cases featured on Unsolved Mysteries. And so to fill out, you know, to make the episode a little bit longer, I thought I'll join two together. Yeah. Seemed to have a good reception to it. So we thought we'd do a couple more of those. So today we're doing the kidnapping of Annie Laurie Herron, also known as Mrs. Millionaire, and the case of Rochester Kane, the disappearance of Rogers Kane, a.k.a. stroke amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so basically we'll tackle the kidnapping of Annie Laurie Heron first. Yep. Now, this was a very, very early episode. This was actually season one, episode 7.
Yeah, that's crazy. And
date aired 9th November 1988.
What
and
I,
it happened in I'm Jackson, sorry. Mississippi. That's right.
What I find so interesting about that is, so this is the first season, episode 7, like yeah. you said, and this case happened only, what, 6 months before it aired?
Yeah.
Which yep. is crazy. I mean, so it's almost like Unsolved Mysteries was not like taking the cheap way out. They were like, let's go take a modern case and yep. talk about it right now. This just happened.
Yeah, and I think maybe time sensitive because of her age as well. So, I mean, it happened on, so it aired 9th of November 1988 and it aired, and the date that it happened was July 26, 1988. So, yeah, about, so not even, so August, September, October, 4 months.
Oh, yeah, 4 months. Jeez. I mean, that's pretty impressive. It also kind of lets us know that Unsolved Mysteries was a very timely show. So they're talking about a case that is active at the moment. And really the amount of work, I mean, I don't know what updates happen between 1988 and now, but I'm kind of getting the gist that this story, for the most part, remained the same.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, she looked just like such a lovely old lady, like everyone's favorite grandmother, the kind that goes over and gives you sweet candy and your mum tells you off for her giving it to you. And, you know, it was just, yeah, such a sweet old lady. She was 72 years old and was the wife of a wealthy businessman called Robert Heron Sr. So, yeah. And yeah.
They'd been married for nearly 50 years, for 48 years. That's like my age. And they lived in the same house. You know, it's like all this kind of stuff where this is like not your typical, but it's almost like these are people who are lifers. You know, these are people who just committed to each other for their entire lives. They raised two children. Annie was kind of respected and loved in her social circles throughout yeah. Jackson, Mississippi.
And I love their wedding photo. They just look so happy.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice wedding photo. She looks, I mean, it's crazy when you see somebody who, you know, older and everything and you compare it, but yeah, you really see her same smile and everything. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. She just looks obviously with a few more wrinkles than that and
sure.
she looked like she had a nice life. So, so on July 26, 1988, Robert had coffee with Annie before leaving for work. He was a successful oil tycoon who was worth an estimated $100 million, so not too bad. Annie hosted her bridge game later in the afternoon. At 3:30, the card game was finished and the maid cleaned up and left after making sure Annie was okay. Annie said she planned to read until Robert returned home.
So can I just ask you, so Robert is the husband, obviously, right?
Yes.
And he's an oil tycoon.
Yes.
But the story goes to somewhere else, which is weird, like, all right, so when you have money, I guess you're investing in this or that and that and this.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll get to it and discuss it.
Yeah. So he obviously knew what he was doing. He was a very successful businessman, so he knew what he was doing. At 4:30 p.m., Robert returned home, but Annie wasn't there. After calling several friends and family to try and find her, he called the police and reported her missing. Now, it's then claimed that Robert then found the ransom note, which stated not to call the police, but he'd already done so.
Yeah, too late.
Yeah, it's like, whoops. Investigators discovered drops of blood on the carpet and blood smears on the front door of the residence, which is never a good sign. Mm. Neighbors reported seeing a suspicious pickup truck and a white van with Florida plates driving by her home, like up and down, sort of surveilling the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Analysts determined that the blood matched Annie's type. I guess that's all they could do DNA wise back then, was match the type and not match who
I feel like they could have done better in 1988. I don't know why I think that, but maybe then they can determine the type quicker than doing a full DNA Matt?
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember that people saying that back in the 80s and 90s, DNA just wasn't. It also depends on where it was in the States or where it was in the world, whether DNA, how far they could send it, how much DNA they were able to collect, because if it was a small sample, they can't always test it and things like that. So,
but we learned that Annie had, she had an intestinal illness that was pretty bad and she required medication, but she didn't have the medication with her. If she didn't take it soon, the condition that she had would be greatly affected. I would imagine that the, in your notes, you write like how sad it is that this poor woman is probably going through agony and because she doesn't have her medication.
Yeah. And also the stress of being kidnapped.
Yeah, well, like it's crazy.
You assume she is kidnapped, but if there's blood on the door and someone's missing, and there were signs of a struggle, then you're pretty sure that she was abducted. So so always when kidnapping happens for ransom, the FBI become involved. And authorities believe that Annie may have just been struck on the head by an intruder, which explained the blood smears by the door. The ransom note was found near the door. It was collected with gloves in case there were fingerprints on it. It was typewritten and contain numerous grammatical and spelling errors. And I found it interesting that many ransom notes are always full of spelling errors and messy writing.
I think it's on purpose.
Yeah, it is on purpose. I just find, you know, like the JonBenet Ramsey ransom note, you know, that was like, which I know we have differing theories about. But, the ransom note itself was like really messy and really long. Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
Oh, it's okay. So I'm looking at the note because you wrote it out here. The note read, and it's going to sound weird because I'm going to read it exactly the way that they wrote it, was, "Mr. Robert Heron, put these people back in the shape they was in before they got mixed up with school pictures. Pay them whatever damages they want and tell them all this so they can know what you're doing, but don't tell them why you are doing it. Do this before 10 days pass. Don't call police." So what I find interesting about a number of these things is while we have grammatical errors, as we pointed out, nothing is spelled incorrectly.
No, that's true. That's
there's true. Punctuation.
Yeah.
The school pictures, which is the name of a company that makes school photographs, is capitalized.
Yes.
Spacing is correct. You know, it's a very questionable, like, pay them whatever damages. All right. So people who say they was put them in back in the shape they was in before, I don't know if that person is really going to use the words pay them whatever damages they want. You know, it sounds kind of like you're faking it.
Yeah, like they're trying to sound more tough than they actually are.
Like, furthermore, you know, it's, I don't think that's you. And it's funny, you mentioned that you're a grammar Nazi and, we just like pull out our red pens and go, nope, nope, nope.
Nope. That's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. Write it correctly. Yes.
The typewriter that it was typed on was manufactured between 1912 and 1927. I've talked about this on Unsolved Mysteries, Rewind before years. I don't know how many years actually the show's been on, but tons of episodes ago.
I think it was May 2020.
Oh, really?
Yep.
So a couple years now, two and a half years. Well, if you own a modern printer, right? I don't know about if this is in black and white, but if you have a color printer, there's actually serial numbers that the printer will print on the paper no matter what you're printing. And it's crazy.
Yeah.
So, I've heard too. There's ways of tracking this stuff.
I mean, I find it weird that they can find out exactly when the typewriter was manufactured, but they can't do much DNA. That's what annoys me.
Well, the typewriters were using specific fonts and the serifs. I have a typesetting background, so I know a lot about the different fonts that are used for real typewriters. Also, some typewriters might have certain letters that drop in a certain way and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I have a typewriter. I actually really like it.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know why. But yeah, I just bought it because I could. And I'm like, oh, I have a typewriter now. I feel weird. But
did you buy, is it a fully mechanical typewriter or an electric typewriter?
It's a fully mechanical one.
Oh, so chick, 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 chick.
Yep.
They're fun.
Yep, the old, yep, traditional one. Yeah, they are. So yeah. I liked that for a while. So
you have to type really well.
Your fingers hurt after a while, yes.
So as we said before, the ransom note refers to School Pictures. And that's a company that handles photographs, like I'm sure you have them when you were a kid, and me with that kind of weird fuzzy background. Like I don't never understood what that is.
They're trying to do it for, you know, effect.
But, you know, nowadays they do it on a green screen and you can put any background you want.
Yeah, that's even more corny.
You get like spaceships and, you know, Britney Spears or something. Yeah,
like I said, corny.
A company that handled photographs school and for school children for yearbooks. Robert had taken over this company in the 80s in order to collect debts because it was a franchise, kind of like Glamour Shots, I guess. Between 1981 and 1983, School Pictures sued 12 of the franchise owners in 8 states, including Florida. And it was later determined that one of the people who was mentioned in this letter had passed away after learning, you know, they kind of went through such financial hardships. And the ransom letter listed 12 franchises of the nationwide business, and Robert was instructed to pay ransom for the return of his wife. But it didn't state how much money or anything. But from what I recall from the Unsolved Mysteries segment, about $1 million was put out.
Yeah.
Seems about excessive.
Well, he was determined to get his wife back, so I guess you wouldn't put a price on it, really. But, you know, you're right. I mean, it didn't state how much
money.
You
never pay ransom. You know, it's like, it's almost like the rule. Like, you just don't pay ransom.
Oh, I love that movie, Ransom, with Mel Gibson. Oh, yeah. Highly recommend if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, watch of course, it. Of course.
So good. So good. But, it didn't tell them how much money was demanded nor where to actually send the money. So he was at a loss. Like, he, you know, the kidnapper claimed that Robert owed these businesses money because he harmed these companies through the business dealings and lawsuits. But if they were being sued, they were obviously dealing in shady business deals, so their companies would have been harmed in, you know, the legal process. Like, it wouldn't have been, you know, it would be their fault, not Robert's fault, for not dealing well in the franchise. It would be the franchise's fault. So, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to me that Robert owed when just because their businesses went corrupt, you know. Since the lawsuits against these companies were in public record, authorities determined that the kidnapper could have been someone that didn't even belong to the franchises. And I wrote, it's possible, but why would someone who wasn't even involved with any of the companies be bothered to even look through public records and decide to kidnap someone for ransom? It could be a relative or a friend or someone involved in the companies.
Or maybe the husband.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, their husband's always the first suspect, so.
Yeah, I don't know. We're not looking at the husband, it seems. I wonder, was there a life insurance policy on her?
Oh, there probably was, but I don't know. Like, I just think the fact that he called the police, he did basically everything he was told not to. I guess the police could think that he was involved, but I don't know.
I mean, we don't know anything about her, really. All we have is some photos and the son talking about her. I mean, she could have been just a tremendous pain in the ass. I mean, I'm not saying she was. I just wish we knew a little bit more about these people.
Yeah. And that's why I feel like Unsolved Mysteries, like, kind of skimmed over this segment, you know, and that's why I decided to do one in two cases in one, because it was just kind of a shorter case, even though there was a lot of information sort of all thrown in at once. But
We also didn't have any character references on Unsolved Mysteries. Like, no, like, best friends and all of that kind of stuff. And I just have to question that.
Yeah, why didn't they, like, interview a bridge club or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, behavioral analyst teams
hypothesized,
thank you very much, that the perpetrator was a white male, middle-aged, who was capable of killing someone who was working alone.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of an old analysis, I think. I mean, anybody can kidnap anybody. I don't know why it would have to be a white male who's middle-aged.
Yeah, I mean, that's like pretty much most people. He deliberately tried to disguise his identity even more by using grammatical spelling errors and using an old typewriter. The usage of the word damages, which is what we discussed before.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
In the typewriter, in the letter, led the team to determine that the perpetrator may be an attorney.
Hmm.
I don't know how they led to that. There was a name on the ransom note of a man who is indeed an attorney, N. Alfred Wynne.
Hmm.
So I don't know how they came to that conclusion. Hey, the word damages. Oh, it must be a lawyer. But then again.
Yeah. Well, Wynne was interviewed at his office, and his alibi was that I was at a strip club looking for a prostitute.
Isn't that everybody's alibi?
Yeah, pretty much. And that's what he was doing when Annie went missing. Wynne also said that he had to contact a paralegal to borrow money for the prostitute, and the paralegal confirmed his story, but investigators believe them both to be lying. They claim they didn't even know what club they were going to. Oh, it was the 80s, it was cocaine, you know.
What a reliable alibi. So looking in more into Wynne's background, he had been in severe financial trouble for about 7 years since the school pitchers lawsuit. He tried to file bankruptcy three times to avoid paying anything back and refused to be evicted from his office. He actually lived upstairs from his work office.
Oof.
Yeah.
What does it mean that he, I mean, I know you are not an expert with American law, but he tried to file bankruptcy three times. I mean, does that mean that he failed at filing bankruptcy?
Maybe he was trying to hide money and they wouldn't let him file it because he was hiding the money.
Because there's chapter 11, which is bankruptcy. That's where, like, all the people that you owe money to, it goes out that you are going to file for bankruptcy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure. But the paralegal claimed that Mr. Wynne, it sounds like a made-up name, felt that the school pictures business had ruined his life. Investigators discovered that the paralegal had a white van similar to the one seen around Annie's neighborhood, but the difference was that it said free candy on the side.
It did not.
No, it didn't. Well, it might have. We don't know it didn't. It might have said free candy.
Or free puppies or something. Oh, God. I watched terrible. Too much Law and Order SVU. I should really stop. It was later found not to be the van as it was being serviced that day. The FBI concluded that the paralegal wasn't involved in the kidnapping, but he may have more information. So he's keeping secrets.
Yeah, the following day, the FBI set up a satellite command post, which always sounds like so, like, ooh, it's a satellite command post. It just means like some guy sitting like in his car. And he tapped Heron's phone in case of a ransom call. It was assumed that Robert was the obvious target of this case due to his business dealings. He was known as a self-made and honest man, but he was also known as being very generous. It was when we did see the television announcement, I thought that felt a little bit weird. Robert made a public appeal for his wife's return in September of 88. If I'm recalling, he said something along the lines of, I've made some weird decisions, or I've made some questionable decisions with, you know, all of this. And I didn't know what he was referring to at that point.
Maybe he was saying, like, well, because he called the police when he wasn't supposed to, and he paid the money, or he could be overthinking, and he could be going back over all these dealings that he'd done over the years and be questioning, going, did I do that right? Was that the right decision? He's probably just going crazy because, you know, he loved his wife so much, and it was pretty sad to see him, you know, plead for his wife's return. But, yeah, it was just really, really sad.
He sent out like $1 million in checks, right? Crazy.
Yeah.
And places return the money. I mean, do you think that they returned the money thinking, like, I don't want anything to do with this kidnapping? Because somebody sends me 150 grand, I'm keeping it.
Yeah. Yeah. But what if it's like, what if you're the only one to accept it out of like 12 other people?
Hey,
you'd be seen as a suspect.
Don't send me $150,000 then.
True.
I know I'm innocent.
Yeah.
I got nothing to do.
That's true.
It's terrible, but it seems kind of crazy that
it's hard to be a really wealthy, successful man without making some enemies. Like, there's always going to be, you know, you could be the most generous, honest person ever, but you're still going to make enemies because what you've done to make yourself successful. You may be honest, but it's still going to annoy other people. So that no one's going to be completely happy with, there's always going to be someone.
Mm-hmm.
So despite Robert being very generous and honest and did everything the right way and built his empire up, you know, there's always going to be someone who's either jealous or pissed off that they didn't get what he got or felt betrayed. There's always going to be that. So
now, in 1988, you had $1 million, which was a hell of a lot of money. Now,
yes.
That's equivalent to today, adjusted for inflation, to nearly $2.5 million.
Wow, that's a lot.
And in Australian money, it sounds even more impressive. Let's see, I'm going to give you 240. Sorry, USD in AU. It's 3.5 million Australian dollars.
Well, that would be nice.
Oh, yeah. You know what I'll take? I'll take 10% of that.
Okay. Sounds good.
We'll split it.
But speaking of the letters, they received 8 days later, it was determined to feature Annie's signature. So, unfortunately, I think that Annie was made to sign this when she was first kidnapped, and I think she was killed shortly afterwards. Also, the fact that it took 8 days to receive correspondence shows that the perpetrator wanted Robert to suffer not knowing where his wife was. So
yeah, they also talked about the way that the envelope was to be handled.
Yes, but we'll read it was. There was one note postmarked from Atlanta, Georgia. The note stated, "Bob, if you don't do what these people want to do, they're going to seal me up in a cellar of this house and with only a few jugs of water. Please save me, Annie Laurie." That's really scary and really sad.
Yeah.
That pressure that was on him, he wouldn't know what to do. So like we said, he mailed checks totaling nearly $1 million. And one of them was sent to one of the suspects, the attorney, N. Alfred Wynn. When he received the check, he claimed to his paralegal that this wasn't what he wanted. What he wanted was his confiscated property back that he had been taken from him during bankruptcy filing. Wow. So he'd obviously been able to file bankruptcy. So half of the franchises actually returned the money to him, stating they didn't want anything. However, Annie Laurie Heron was never released and the kidnapper never contacted him again.
So what do you think happened? I mean, it seems like this is a lot of work to do what was done.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't need to kidnap this woman.
And it was a mess. Like, I just think this person didn't have much experience in doing this. What, you know, maybe it was, I don't know if it was a casual, like it was a spur of the moment thing because, you know, the white van was sort of gone trailing up and down the street and the place was obviously being surveillance. But I don't know. I just think that it was just a mess and just didn't have to happen. It was horrible. But the suspects, authorities suspected that one of the people from the 12 franchise listed in the note may have been involved in the abduction. A suspicious white cargo van from Florida plates was seen in the neighborhood around the time of Annie's abduction. But were the license plates tracked? It turns out they were. They tried to track them, but discovered the plates were stolen from a car at a New Orleans airport. So that was another dead end. So they never found out anything about the van, really. So,
but in March of 89, if we fast forward to the people who may have actually done something here, Newton Alfred Wynn, who's 65 years old at the time, the attorney at the strip bar, he was a civil attorney in St. Petersburg, Florida. He was arrested and charged with Annie's kidnapping. Now, I don't know what evidence they had. I mean, aside from just, I don't know. I don't know what kind of, how do you arrest somebody without evidence? He was the owner of the Florida-based, he was the owner, not one of the School Pictures franchise and one of the 12 names listed. And he was also one that sent back the money.
Oh, maybe he did it to turn away suspicion from himself.
Maybe it was, he was like, I didn't think this through. It was the hooker's idea. It wasn't my idea. 4 years before Annie's abduction, he had been sued by a company for over $153,000. It could be possible that might have ruined him.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, he just seems to hold grudges. He just seems like a grumpy man who just made so many wrong decisions, and it's like blaming everybody else.
Right. A month before the kidnapping, he'd purchased a van that matched the description of the one that we're talking about, and the one that says free candy. It doesn't really say that, but it might have. Annie's neighbors saw around her house, that same van on the day that she was kidnapped. The description of the van's driver also matched his appearance, which I guess would mean like frumpy four eyes. Two witnesses had also identified Wynn as a man that they had seen in the van in the weeks prior to the abduction. So it's possible, definitely. If I'm going to point my finger, I'm going to point my finger at him and the husband. That's just me, though.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know if the husband had anything to do with it. I don't. But like you said, she could be a giant pain in the ass, and he was just like, I want to live my senior years in peace.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Just authorities also learned that Wynn had asked his paralegal to help him fabricate an alibi for the day of the kidnapping, which never looks good.
No.
A woman who was apparently a spiritual advisor contacted the FBI and told them she had met Wynn 4 years prior. Once she had guaranteed protection, she was willing to discuss him. She claimed Wynn had promised her $500 to travel from Florida to Atlanta, Georgia, and mail a letter for him 16 days after the kidnapping. He handed her a manila envelope. Inside was a second letter wrapped in a grey linen napkin. Wynn instructed her not to look at or touch the letter, but when she deposited the letter, she was to ease the napkin off. That is when she observed the writing on the letter. Later, she identified the letter as one that Robert had received from his wife. So she appeared to be a very good witness for the FBI.
Mm.
So they even managed to find the discarded napkin that the woman had tossed on the roadside a year earlier. This was extremely helpful, but police still wanted an actual confession from Wynn. Investigators urged her to arrange meetings with Wynn to try to get him to admit incriminating evidence against himself. He never admitted to any wrongdoing regarding Annie Herron. So he must have known, maybe he didn't trust the paralegal completely, and he wasn't going to reveal anything.
This is like, it is crazy. The attorney Wynn also sent a huge filing cabinet to the IRS challenging them to find any damning evidence against him, which of course, he would conveniently leave out any of that damning evidence.
Exactly. Yes. That's easy
to say. The FBI located an ex-girlfriend of Wynn's who is, at first she was hesitant, but then admitted that Wynn had planned to kill her husband. So the guy's, he does have that history, and people are pointing their fingers at him. I just feel like, is it possible he was hired to do this? Or maybe more than one person is involved here.
Yeah, there is that option. There is that. I mean, it's just hard to say. Like I said, we don't get much information. We just don't know. And Wynn's not talking, so obviously because he's dead. But, yeah, it's just he didn't talk before that, and so it's hard to know anything more. And obviously the more time passes, the less we're going to find out. Yeah. So
to add to it, Wynn owned a cabin in the Florida swamplands, which, you know, there's probably alligators, you know, gator. Yeah. If you wanted to dispose a body, that might be a really great place for it.
Yes, and the FBI did search there and looked for the cellar that Annie's letter claimed she was being kept in, but there was no evidence that there was a connection to the kidnapping.
I'm sure whatever that was also written specifically like that to throw them off.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Though he maintained his innocence, Wynn was convicted of conspiracy to commit kidnapping, extortion, and perjury in 1990. He was sentenced to 19 years and 7 months and was released from prison in April 2006, and he died in August 2012. And I think he knew what happened to Annie, or I think he knows more, and he never revealed it, and that adds insult to injury, in my opinion. I think that's just terrible.
Yeah. What happened to the husband? Oh, you have it here. Robert died of a heart attack. Oh, and he probably have a broken heart too. In 1990.
A year and a bit afterwards, Robert died of a heart attack. So the following year, Annie was legally declared dead, and no one has ever been formally charged with the actual kidnapping of Annie, nor has she ever been found. And she was born in 1915, so I'm pretty sure she's not alive now. If she was, she'd be like 107, maybe some kind of record. So, she's definitely not alive, which is really sad. So,
I think the swamplands. I think that her body was dumped in the swamplands.
Oh yeah, definitely. And she wouldn't have lasted long anyway. She seemed pretty frail. She apparently walked with like a stoop and had osteoporosis and scoliosis and stuff. And
poor woman.
And yeah, so she, you know, she's definitely gone. Rest her soul. It was just a really sad thing. And like I think that Robert would have obviously not died so early if it wasn't. For what happened to her, I think he just died of a broken heart, basically. Yeah,
that's a real thing.
So, yeah, definitely.
Well, for this next case, though, we head over to Los Angeles. Around the same time of the year. Around the same year. Yeah, 1986. It's February 18th, 1986. Aired November 30th, 1988.
Season 1, episode 10.
Yeah, just 3 episodes later.
Yep, and we've got a man here by the name of Rogest Kane.
Which is a weird first name. I never heard of that name, Rogest.
No, I'm assuming it'd be Roger, but people might just call him Roger, but yeah. I'd have trouble calling him Rogest. It's really odd.
Yeah, Rogest Kane was a family man and had always hoped to create a better life for his 7 children. And in 1958, he moved from Mississippi to Los Angeles, California. Big step.
Yes, and I'd move there too if I was living in Mississippi in 1958.
Yeah, it's a good point. There he was able to give his children advantages that they had never had. And you're bringing up a very good point. 1958, being in Mississippi, very, very tough time to be an African-American.
Yep.
And Los Angeles, of course, being a much better place for a person of color, especially even in 1958. His children say that he was always a loving, caring father to them. By 1986, which is nearly, 30 years later, Rogest was 62 years old and worked for the Department of Parks and Recreation. On the afternoon of February 18th, 1986, it was probably still warm out because it's LA, he left his home, telling his sister that he was going to the hardware store, but he never returned home.
And I wrote, I assumed his family were interviewed when he was first went missing, because it'd be interesting to see if there were any clues to suggest Rogers was planning to disappear or any hints of a possible medical issue. Again, this is another one where we don't get very many interviews shown in the segment, which is why it was so short. But basically, since his disappearance, several clues have surfaced to suggest that he's still alive on February 19th, so the day later, he called a neighbour and told her that he wasn't feeling well and could not go to work. But why did he call the neighbour? Did he work with his neighbour? Why not call a family member, as they were obviously concerned with his whereabouts? Like, was he that confused that he called a neighbour? Why didn't he call his work, you know?
Well, some people might have a neighbour who's like a best friend.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true.
You can go on.
Yep. When he didn't come home, his family called the police, which, as you do. They also contacted hospitals and other relatives to try to locate Rogest. 2 days later, a private security company in an affluent neighbourhood spotted a man who they believed to be Rogest. The man appeared very confused and gave the officers a phone number that belonged to his sister, Teresa. However, when Teresa came to pick up her brother, he disappeared again. And I don't get it. Why didn't the people at the privacy security company keep him until his sister could come pick him up? Why would they say, you know, you okay, and him give the number?
Well, they might not have the right to. Maybe he's like, you're not keeping me here, you know?
Yeah, I guess maybe he became like a bit like.
Well, you don't want to also get involved too much, you know? It's kind of like.
Yeah, true.
You don't pay me enough, you know?
But yeah, I don't know. It's just, it sounds like, to me, it's, and I'm jumping ahead, but to me, it sounds like a head injury or stroke causing amnesia. Mm-hmm. Like, or just like a stroke can do a lot to the memory. Like just a couple of years ago, my dad had a very big heart scare and he had to have a heart operation.
Oh, wow.
And would have been 6 weeks later, he was at home and I was sitting with him and he suddenly had this memory lapse and I could see that his face was going sort of droopy. So I thought he was having a stroke. Oh. It turns out it wasn't that. It was like some orbital translation thing where his mind wasn't connecting with his speech, and it was something that can be quite common after the anesthesia from the operation.
Wow.
So he was really lucky that it wasn't anything serious like a stroke, not even a mini stroke.
That must have been horrifying though.
Oh, it scared the heck out of me. I mean, we were watching an episode of Game of Thrones and he kept repeating the same thing over and over again. And earlier that day, someone had brought him flowers. And like one, just a friend of his. And I said, oh, they're nice. When did you get those flowers? And he's like, what flowers? And I'm like, the flowers right here. And he goes, I don't remember getting them. Aren't they fit for you? I said, no, they're for you. You told me that so-and-so came by to drop them off. When did they drop them off? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Wow.
And he got quite agitated. So who knows? Maybe Roger got really agitated when people kept asking him questions because he didn't really know how to answer them.
It could be scary too. You know, oh, I'm sure your father was also kind of like, what the hell's going on with me?
Yeah, yeah. He's one of those men that are very, very smart. So he kind of, not saying you're dumb when if you don't know, but like he was aware something was happening and he was quite frightened.
Yeah, you're confused.
Yeah.
A month goes by and Rogest's car was found parked on a busy street 22 miles away, which is like 40 kilometers. All of his papers, his GI bill, the deed to his property, his insurance paper, his glasses and even his false teeth were all in the car.
Wow.
I don't know why he would even take out his teeth, but there were also pieces of paper that had his daughter's phone number written several times. That kind of makes it seem a little bit like you were saying with your dad, like repeating. His family believes that he was trying to remember her number. Oh, it's just so sad.
Yeah, he was definitely having some sort of medical episode affecting his memory.
Yeah. And at the gas station next to his abandoned car, authorities learned that Rogest had talked to the mechanic on the day after he disappeared. The mechanic said that he repaired parts of his car, and Rogest paid him in cash, and the mechanic said that Rogest was slurring his speech and walking oddly. He last saw Rogest walking down the street away from the gas station.
Yeah, why would he leave his car if it'd just been fixed and wandered away? Authorities and Roger's family believe that he may have suffered a stroke and is suffering from memory loss.
Mm-hmm.
Authorities discovered that Roger's telephone credit card had been used several times since he was seen by the security company. The calls made on Roger's card were all traced. All of them were numbers from help wanted ads in the local newspaper. It's believed that when Roger's went missing, he still had the need to find work so that he could get money, obviously, because they said that he paid for the car payment in cash. although his memory was impaired, he still realized he needed money and that he needed to call places to find work.
Right.
It's very interesting that parts of the brain aren't affected during a medical episode and some that are. It's very interesting that he knew he needed money.
Yeah, it's like a common sense factor that just doesn't go away.
Yeah, and authorities and his family believe that he was picked up by law enforcement, or probably hoped he was picked up by law enforcement or a paramedic and transported to the hospital for medical treatment as a John Doe. They hope he's still being taken care of somewhere. However, no other evidence has ever been found to suggest that he's still alive.
Oof.
And foul play was not suspected in his disappearance. He was born October 12, 1924, so there is a chance that he could still be alive, but he'd be in his late 90s. Was 5'7" and 165 pounds. He was widowed, but there's no information about his wife. We did say he was a Parks and Recreation Department worker. He was an African-American male with black hair and brown eyes. Rogers is the father of former NFL player Lynn Cain, who was interviewed for the segment briefly, and he is also the grandfather of rapper Will.i.am, who was in Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah. I don't know much about Will.i.am. I know the name. But, that's an interesting connection.
Yeah,
Sad. It's a very sad situation because it really leaves you. These are two cases that are genuinely unsolved.
Yeah.
Which I don't believe that we're going to ever get a resolution.
Not on
any Heron or Rogest Kane's cases.
Yes. So when the story first aired, several viewers called claiming that a man living in Topeka, Kansas, now how would he have gotten from LA to Topeka, named Elmer Jackson, might have been Rogest. The viewers noticed that Jackson didn't have any dentures and had a scar on his body that matched Rogest. So how could they get so close to him about a scar?
They made a reference to the scar, which I thought was kind of weird. They said that the scar, how did they put it? They made it seem like the scar would have been in an intimate area.
Yeah, so how did they notice the scar? I'd be like, pull down your pants. Let us see.
Let's say it was on his chest, you know?
Yeah.
So it's hard to say. But
unfortunately, he disappeared before the police could question him. There is this option as well. Maybe he had some sort of mental breakdown for whatever reason and didn't want to be found. He was spotted then disappeared before family could get there to see him. It's a theory, but his described behavior, like I said, sounds more like a medical episode, as I previously stated.
Yeah, I think he had the stroke and it just, he probably fell into the system and he just didn't make it.
Yeah. You can continue if you like.
You point out how his siblings, Teresa, Marguerite, Clarence, Curtis, and Roland, have since passed away. And in his obituary, Rogest is listed as having predeceased them, which is pretty sad.
Yes. We forgot a bit. Within days of the... That's right.
I jumped Roger's over
son, That's okay. Rogest's son, Lynn, flew to Topeka to aid police in the search. They've since learned that Elmer lived in Topeka for about a year after a truck driver brought in their IRC. So that answers that question. He apparently worked several jobs, including as a bricklayer. Lynn and the police canvassed the neighborhood where Rogers apparently lived, but they were unsuccessful. It would be so difficult to get calls and get your hopes up about your loved ones and fly there and only be found that, the hopes are dashed and all of that.
The online consensus, as well as I think maybe what we think, is that he had a stroke and didn't get treated, maybe turned, who knows what happened, and he just lost his memory and just kind of, I don't know, maybe his health just kept declining.
Yeah, he seemed like a strong man. He probably didn't want to admit something was wrong because, like, people that are born in the 20s, like my grandfather, they never, he wouldn't complain about anything unless it was really bothering him, maybe he was that sort of man, and it sounds like he was a hard worker all his life, and he had seven children to start with. So and others believe that the family rushed to declare Rogers dead, maybe a settlement property due to alleged sightings of him. But, you know, how true were the sightings? Maybe they wanted to get their hands on the money, but I doubt it.
It didn't seem like he was that wealthy or anything. It seemed like he was a working guy. He probably had some savings, but...
Yeah, exactly. People also speculate that his health eventually deteriorated so much that he ended up in a nursing home under the name John Doe, where he passed away, and he's buried somewhere in an unmarked grave, and that's really sad. And then Rogers was declared legally dead in 1995, and sadly he's never been found.
Yeah.
So if he'd be alive today, he'd be, what, 97, 98? So I don't think he's alive.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't think he's at 98. I mean, he may have died alone, but he didn't die unloved. You know, like there were people out there who were looking for him and thinking about him, and still, you know, people are talking about him, you know, 30 years after he went missing.
Yeah, it just would be good to have closure for those sorts of cases.
Of course. You know,
but, you know, it is what it is.
Not today.
No, not today.
Not through us, not today.
Not through us, not today. But maybe one day, you never know.
Yeah. Well, Laura, this is two more cases. And thank you so much for all the work that you put into each and every episode of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind.
That's okay. I love to do it, you know me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love being here to discuss these cases, and I look forward to the next one.
Yes, me too. And remember to follow us on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind on Facebook and also Instagram. We do post when new episodes will be coming up. And I think, would you be releasing another episode next week maybe?
Or? Yeah, I'm coming. Well, it won't be in line with this particular episode, but there should be episodes in early December.
Excellent. So look out for that. So sounds good to me.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and just stay on the line.
Thank you.